The subject for the evening talk is the emptiness of busyness. We live in a world which quite often is full of many self-deceptions. We live in a very productive society, and we have become, perhaps foolishly, rather proud of the number of labour-saving, time-saving gadgets. Our homes are quite often filled with them. We are more efficient in the way that we move from one place to another, and all the sophistication that technology brings to us, so that we can get from A to B much more quickly. We can communicate through the machinery, the telephone and the fax and the modem. We can relate in all manner of ways, in which are all time-saving, so we are told. And it seems that the rather harsh reality of our life, that we've got even less time on our hands, we are busier than ever, and it makes something of a joke of time-saving gadgets. And our busyness of going from one thing to another becomes an incredibly strong pattern. We don't want people telephoning us, rather knocking on our front door, without a prior appointment. First they ring the telephone, get the disembodied voice on it, which says, "Thank you for your call. Please leave a brief message after the signal." And we live in a world of bizarre channeling from one to another. And this busyness fills our existence. And then we produce a convenient word for us to feel comfortable with. We call it stress. So then we have to produce a huge consumer industry to deal with stress. We produce the forms of going to the gymnasium with all those sophisticated items there to work off our stress. We produce a whole range of clothing to deal with stress through the various sports and activities. We buy books on it. We pay expensive psychotherapists $50-$70 an hour to help us deal with our stress in day-to-day life. We go on retreats. We go overseas. We go to terribly expensive workshops which last from 10 till 5 and pay large sums of money. And we think, what on earth is going on in our life that we are calling this living normality or whatever? And sometimes when we stop and we say, well, what is stress? What is this phenomena of stress, tension? And perhaps there are two strong emotional components which accompany our stress. One of them, somewhere in it, is desire, and somewhere in it, there's fear. I've got so much to do, perhaps I won't get it all done. If I don't get what I've done, perhaps I'll lose the job. I'll lose the contract. They want me to finish this by a certain date, but I've only got so much time and I'm not sure if I'll get it finished. But I want to get it finished. So stress is a polite word for the combination of desire and fear running through our psyche. And we've got so used to this busy, busy, busy life that we hardly have any time or energy for anything else. And we come home in the evening, and about all the energy that's left is to turn the television off on. But there's not enough energy through the entire course of the evening to turn it off. And it becomes our way of being in this world. It becomes normal lifestyle. And we can't see what's obsessive, somewhat neurotic, out of touch with life. And the extraordinary thing about our busyness, which we like to boast about, I'm terribly busy at the moment, I have so much to do, there's a certain self-pride which goes along with it. I have such a busy life. Phone never stops ringing, all these letters to do, people to meet, places to go. It gives us the feeling that we're important. And so we like to have the label of being a very busy person hanging around us. But unfortunately, with the mind, in its busyness, we lie down at night to go to sleep. Oh, God, I must have some sleep. I really need some rest. But the busyness, it's like those car engines. I don't know if you've got an old car like mine, 14 years old. You've been out on a long drive and it's a hot day. And you arrive at the destination, you turn it off, and the motor is still going on. You know, if you have an English car, you know exactly what I mean. And sometimes our mind is like this at the end of the day. We desperately want to turn it off. Want some rest, want some sleep. The customary gin and tonics not doing the job for us. And so we lie down and the engine of the mind is still turning over. And we might ask ourselves, in the middle of all of that, is that what my life is? Stress, busyness, hurrying, going from one thing to another. And perhaps part of the motivation that accompanies this fragmented and odd way of living is that we feel we are achieving something. It's the result which matters. But the result, which is the effect of all our doing, becomes the start and the cause for something else. So the busyness gets a momentum. And you and I can say to ourselves and to our friends and families, as soon as this is over, as soon as I finish this job, I'm going to have some breathing space. I'm going to take it easy. I'm going to live with some sanity in my life. I'm going to be more cooled out. Fat chance. Not much hope, I'm afraid. Because the momentum of the tendency, the force of the pattern inside, that no sooner does one stop than it starts up again. One takes a few days holiday by the Dead Sea because one feels so dead and it feels an appropriate place to go to. And one comes back full of good intentions, and once again the momentum has started all over again. Pressure, internal pressure, external pressure. Surely there has to be another way of living and being in this world. And part of the deception of the many that's in the culture and in the society which you and I share, part of the deception is the idea that one is or will achieve something, that one's really going to get something out of it. And we do. But it needs the cooperation of others, their affirmation, which is often a primary reason for doing things, so that other people's states of mind will turn to our existence and say, you did a fantastic job there. In a way, we substitute mother and father from the past and we generate the new mother and father as the authority in terms of society, in terms of our peers, in terms of others that we associate, and we search for their approval. Still behaving like children. No, really, that's an insult to children. Sometimes they show more wisdom and more intelligence than us who are parents. So looking at ourselves, the movement, the desire for achievement, the pursuing of it, the stress that so often goes with it, makes us afraid It makes us afraid. Because if we say to ourselves, this has to change, and we really say to ourselves deeply and sincerely, this has to change, then fear would probably come. Oh my God, if I start changing, this is all I know. Living a neurotic way of life. Been living it my whole life. I got tremendous encouragement to live it. And if I suddenly stop and say, this needs to change, then all manner of confusion, uncertainty, self-doubt can come in, because all we know is running after, running after, running after, running after, and so much of it wanting approval. The pursuit of approval. Now life gets driven by this pursuit. I would compare it in our mind, in our Western mind, but it's a mind which has been exported successfully, I would say, all over the world. It's a mind with a virus. The virus of wanting approval, wanting approval, wanting approval. And sometimes we will go to any lengths to get it. Any lengths to get it. Coming into a retreat, outwardly can generate quite a contrast. Here it's the art of doing as little as possible. Doing so little that any little gestures becomes too much. And we can't understand it, and some of you have expressed in the small groups and other times, you can't understand. If I stop doing, what's going to happen to me? If I actually cut off temporarily the process of doing and just be, what will happen to me? And for some of you have been experiencing with understandably much difficulty that the moment we stop doing, it seems to allow and give the opportunity for all manner of unpleasant things to surface dramatically. Wandering mind, thinking, fears, agitations, confusion, states of mind, guilt, uncertainty, various desires for roles, for positions, etc. Suddenly that this busyness has stopped. We've come into a silent and relatively still place, and we think, well, because I'm being still physically, relatively, because I'm not talking to a lot of people, somehow we think, well, inwardly I should be like that. But inwardly can be revealing a tremendous upsurge of commotion. Different ways and different strengths, two different people in this room. Your life is being lived out of that commotion. It's the background to your existence. And if it's the background, it becomes the foreground. The unconscious, to use other terms, becomes the conscious. It influences, it informs, it shapes our way of life. But remarkably, and rather fortunately, the mind is a very vast dimension. As vast as this world is that you and I look out upon, this universe that you and I look out upon, as vast as it is, as extensive as it is, as deep as it is, it's never 1 centimeter vaster or more deep than the mind. The mind is a vast, deep field. So vast and deep, as you and I know, it can embrace and accommodate any contradiction in life. It's so big, it can accommodate the beautiful and the ugly, the right and the wrong, the positive and the negative, the confusion and the clarity, the fear and the courage, the kindness and the hate. It's such a vast dimension, it accommodates anything. So when we go into the internal universe and begin to explore that, for some, we think, gosh, despite my life and my way of living, there is some space inside. There is some peacefulness, some clarity, some calm. And some of you have expressed quite some gratitude and some surprise that in being here and doing nothing, that all hell isn't breaking loose from inside. I want to stop thinking, wee, there is some space inside. This space within has beautiful significance for each and every one of us. So when we speak of going deeply into ourselves and deeply into who we are, at times that might mean in our meditations the facing of difficult patterns or hindrances, as the Buddhist tradition sometimes refers to, tendencies of mind. So plenty of the thoughts which arise are not consequential at all. They are comparable to leaves on the trees. When you and I look up at these lovely trees here, we don't say, there are too many leaves on that tree, there should be less. Oh, when those leaves fall out of the tree, why aren't they falling in nice, orderly, clear piles, neat, so that people don't have to sweep them up or whatever? Inner life, mental life, thought life is a bit tree-like. Out of the mind comes lots of thoughts like lots of leaves. Of course they do. Natural production of mind is producing of thought. And the thoughts come into consciousness and pass out of consciousness, etc. And have no significance. We hopefully are spacious. We just accommodate the thoughts. But there are some thoughts which have got something else going on with them. They've got a charge in them. They've got ego. They've got identification in them. They've got investment in them. They've got a build-up of a picture in them. They've got something else going on in them. So the various thoughts that come and pass, never mind, life is coming and passing, so why shouldn't those thoughts? But what about the thoughts which we have made something of? What about those? And how easily, with those thoughts which are arising inside of us, we have this strange, illogical thought which says, if I keep thinking about this, whatever it is, long enough, I'll come to an answer. If I keep thinking long enough, I'll come to an answer. And if one keeps thinking long enough, one will keep coming to another thought. And we live in the world of circulating, circulating thoughts. And with it, the want for a solution, the looking for an answer, to be successful somewhere. So one of the questions that a human being needs to ask herself or himself with some consistency, in all of my busyness and in all of the stress which I have that goes with it, what's the cost? What is the cost? To give a small example in day-to-day life for a moment, I met a very interesting and rather spirited and courageous woman some time ago who, her husband worked for an oil company and had worked his way up the corporate ladder, earning quite a considerable income, $500,000 or more, had lived in 8 different places, and was a company man, that's how they like to describe themselves, a company man. And one of the difficulties is keeping the wives entertained. And she was in Amsterdam, she told me, and in this, the company, the old company, had arranged a diamond and furs, you know what furs are, you know, you don't probably, thank God, have to wear them in this country, but diamonds and furs sale for the wives of the company director, the kind of auction. She told me she hated it, but she was afraid to say to the other company wives that, because they said, but, you know, you have such a wealthy lifestyle, etc. Over the phone, it came out of it, I hate the company, I hate the old firm, I hate this way of life, I hate all the superficiality of it all. And to her surprise, her friend said, I agree with you. I hate it as well. I always hated it, etc. All going unexpressed. She went home to her husband. She said, I can't go on living like this. And he said to her, what do you mean? All I've done for you, the usual one-liners that men like to use, all I've done for you, I've given my career to make you happy and content. You need a psychoanalyst. You ungrateful bitch, he told her. A few months later, it was au revoir to her husband. She said, I left him to come home at night to cook his own dinner. And she was living in a one-bedroomed apartment in another city, learning yoga, doing meditation, having a low-income office job, and she said to me, I've never been so happy in all my life. So I say sometimes in situations, it's pressure, reaction, stress, and it's intolerable. In a way, despite everything, sometimes in some situations, if it can't be worked with, one must express one's human right as a human being to find one's freedom. Women's movement has made a fabulous contribution to the understanding of liberation in the last decades. To actually have the right if the situation is intolerable. Some situations, it's not having to change it. It's changing the relationship to it. We have to look at ourselves in life and to know ourselves in the way that we are living and our experience of life. Do I need a very dramatic change? If so, where am I going to find the courage and the spirit and the passion for it, for liberation, for freedom in that way? And if I don't need to make that kind of change, what's the change or changes I need to make from within in relationship to what I do? So that my heart can truly say of itself, there isn't stress in my life. There's joy instead. I'm not trapped in the forces of fear and desire, yet I'm fully participating in a truly engaged life. I'm not living in the cave. I'm not living in the cell. I'm not living in the monastery. I'm living in the world. I'm participating in it, but it's with joy. What are the changes that needs to be made? Because that transformation surely has to be one of the greatest transformations available for a human being who is willing to take risks. And quite often for that, we need each other. We do need support for liberation. We do need support for inquiry, for discovery. We do need to listen to the voices of people that we know with whom we sense there is a wisdom about life, there is a kindness about life, there is a freedom about life, and wherever those voices are, and you know, sometimes they're living next door to us and we don't even realize it. In our meditations and in the process of our meditations, in our connecting with ourself, one of the supportive factors with the area of difficulty of certain mind states, apart from the exploration of it, is to know and to recognize that whatever state of mind comes into being comes about through the conditions, and it also dissolves. Whatever arises in life passes. Been acknowledged, obviously, common day knowledge, but the knowledge tends to be here. And what we're interested in is exploring and finding that heartfelt awareness and that heartfelt perception of living in a world of dynamic change, living in a world of activity. And the most important activity to us in life is the activity of one's state of mind. One's state of mind tends to be the primary interest of our existence. What is our state of mind? And as I say, any state of mind, it arises, it's formed in conditions, and it dissolves. With unpleasant states of mind which arise, negativity, aversion, greed, fear, guilt, references have been made to these in the inquiry this afternoon in the small groups and one-to-ones. When it arises, and we know we're caught up in that, I'd mentioned the example so common in life, we want to give somebody else some feedback. We try to say it's that's our intention. We're not honest. If we really look at ourselves, it might be something else that's going on. A common one, very common, is the desire for revenge. Parents, a parent, will hold back their children for all sorts of public reasons. Oh, I don't trust my children with him anymore. I don't that, etc., etc. Or him to her, whatever it might be. May not be anything of that. It's simply crude, ancient desire for revenge. I have been hurt, so now I've got ways through control to hurt you. I want this, I want that. Not because one really wants whatever it might be, it's to hurt. It's to make the other person's life as painful and as unpleasant and as problematic as possible. That's the issue. So a human being who is looking at herself or himself will look very carefully into the motivations and the intentions which influence our action. We look carefully at it. Sometimes you and I, something impacts upon us. It might come in a memory in your meditation. You remember something about somebody you know, and then some thoughts come, and they have some intentions and some feelings and some emotions of going with those thoughts. Have we got enough space inside of us to look and say, in that, where am I coming from inside of myself? Where am I coming from? What voice within myself, in this moment, in this painful experience, am I listening to? And it's not easy to live wisely and kindly in this world. Because to do that, we've got to listen to the deepest place inside of ourselves and to be incredibly knowing of who we are. Few people in life know who they are. Because we've got to look terribly deeply, deeply inside. And similarly, if we acknowledge the rise and fall of experiences, the rise and fall of states of mind, and we're familiar with that, just in a single day, how many states of mind have you and I witnessed during today? How many different feelings, moods, thoughts, observations, judgments have you and I seen come and go in ourself today? And where there is that kind of charge and investment through history upon us, do we have the capacity to have enough space in that time to see this judgment, this reaction is just forming in conscious right now, passing out of consciousness? Do I have to live my life from that state of reaction? And a human being who has lots of observation and lots of experience and lots of awareness of the rise and fall of mind states will know them so well and so intimately, the wisdom will say, this one isn't worth acting from. This one just isn't worth starting from. It will come and it will pass. And I notice sometimes in myself, on various issues, social, political, comes to mind immediately, and other issues, I'll sit down and I was just doing one for Rowan and friends just before coming here in the room just now, writing a letter. And one puts out a letter, one wants to make a statement or a protest. I'm sure you and I have done this in different ways in our time. And then, the following morning, we said, I won't post it. I'll just wait overnight. I'll sleep on it. And in the morning, if I still feel, I remind myself of this whenever I send out a cruise missile to various organizations. You know what a cruise missile is? It's the equivalent of, what do they send from Iraq? Scud. It's a Scud missile. Sometimes we can write a letter, effectively, it's a verbal Scud missile to somebody or an organization. And I have an agreement with myself that if I've just written a Scud missile, I'll sleep on it overnight, and I'll wake up the following morning. And on plenty of occasions, I woke up the following morning, I said, hey, tear it up. I don't want to send this letter. I wouldn't want to receive such a letter, and therefore I don't want to send such a letter. And I'll try to find another language. Straightforward, clear, precise, but without that tone in it, that that goes, can go with it. All this is part of looking and knowing ourselves in where are we coming from in our action. If we don't know that, we don't know ourselves. That is to know oneself. And the Eastern tradition has said ad nauseam to us, atmavidya, 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 atma, self, vidya, knowledge, the knowing of self. And the knowing of self is a lifelong process. And somebody says, I know myself. That person has just said, I don't know myself. Because there's a conceit, because knowing of self is an unfoldment, an ongoing process of life. And we have a duty. Sometimes the responses and the state of mind which comes from deep within is not from reaction, but it's from joy. It's from generosity. It's from awareness. It's from a clarity. It's from a pure perception there. And in that, we act on behalf of. Spiritual life has consistently stated there are four pillars of spiritual life. Each of these pillars matter equally. Devotion, meditation, service, and knowledge which is transforming. Knowledge which, not intellectual, but a knowing of, a knowing about. Inquiry, reflection, teachings, or whatever. Devotion, meditation, service, and knowing. These are the pillars of spiritual life. Sometimes we hear the word devotion. I don't want to go off on a other tangent, though I'm tempted. We hear devotion and we think of devotion as going to the synagogue or the mosque or whatever. We have to look, to what in life are we devoted to? How does devotion show itself in our day-to-day life? I mean, look at what devotion is. When we're coming from a place inside of ourselves of love, kindness, generosity, warmth, service, however you and I might describe it, the ego, the I and the my, can easily enter into it. It can start showing itself as, I am helping you. I am doing something for you. In ordinary language, it's quite appropriate, particularly for the many of you who are in the professional fields, to say, oh, I have a certain skill in this, and I share my skill with this, I contribute, or whatever. But how easily the I comes in, I and the my comes in, with the action, and it's got something extra which we don't need to go with it. And that extra infiltrates into the love, into the compassion, into the generosity, into the awareness. It may be used to make one feel good about oneself. It may be used because the subtext is to get something back from the other person in some way or other. And sometimes in the New Age circles, one hears this, what I call ugly market mentality, which says, well, I'm giving you my energy, and the only energy you can give me is in your checkbook. And people asking and demanding quite high sums. Well, I give a lot of energy, so money is an energy, therefore you give me a lot of energy in money going back. marketplace mentality in things which should not be of that order. So, can we, in our awareness of life, when those warm, spontaneous expressions come, in our meditations, in the walking, in the day, of things that we contribute to this world, can we, in that there, see that the value is the action? Not, I am doing this for you. Not, I'm going to get something from you for me. But the beauty and the loveliness is the doing itself. Why do we don't need the approval of other people? One's heart knows that one's in the right place because one has looked at one's existence with care and attention. The action's a lovely thing. To give, to share, to respond, to be, to do, to connect with. And one feels the appreciation and acknowledgement of that. Others may like it or dislike it, may approve or disapprove, but one knows all of that. One hears and listens to all of that. But deep, deep down, one knows the action is the expression. The action is the beautiful thing, and no other human being can add to it or subtract from it. So then we begin to understand that if we can explore a deep inner space within us, action will come from that space. Action will come from that space. So instead of us living a life of being compelled to do things because there's no space inside, and we're just pushed, doing, pushed along by pressure, by thoughts, by reaction, by habit, by tendency, that you and I have been willing, and in fact are willing, to stop, to be still, to stop all the madness of doing, to give ourselves a few days to be still with life, to go out in the evening after the talk and look across that fabulous olive grove there, and all the generations of men and women have toiled in those fields, or the people that live in the area, the lovely sky at night, the coolness of the evening, and feeling the stillness of all of that, and equally important, feeling the stillness of all of that, and the space which accommodates all of this. And out of this space comes action and activity. And can we step back, not reject, not deny, but step back and give ourselves this opportunity to be still in our sittings, in our walking, in our silences, to reconnect, see the comings and goings of the unpleasant states of mind, but not use those states of mind for action against ourselves or against other people. In any way, not to do that. And to listen so you sense a greater space. And perhaps the actions, the true actions of life, in fact, paradoxically, come from non-doing. From the ground of non-doing, everything happens marvelously, mystically, magically, in an enlightened and liberated way. And that when we're caught up in doing, pushed and pulled by circumstances, with the fear and desire that runs through it like a thread, we say, let me stop. Let me be still. Let me find a space and let the action come from that spaciousness. And out of that, we call this a liberated and enlightened life. And these teachings are about that alone. May all beings see into life. May all beings see into the nature of things. May all beings be liberated. So let's have a couple of silent minutes together, shall we please? 2 or 3 minutes.